She wore a dirty coat, woolen mittens, and felt boots. Her blonde hair was pulled back and covered with a colorless rag tied under her chin. Her face was smeared with mud, but she still looked sexy. She wielded the shovel in a steady rhythm, working efficiently. Then the supervisor blew a whistle and work stopped. Zoya sat on a stack of sandbags and took from her coat pocket a small packet wrapped in newspaper. Volodya sat beside her and said, "You could have got exemption from this work."
"It's my city," she said.
"Why wouldn't I help to defend it?"
"So you're not fleeing to the east?"
"I'm not running away from the motherfucking Nazis." Her vehemence surprised him. "Plenty of people are."
"I know. I thought you'd be long gone. You have a low opinion of me. You think I belong to a selfish elite."
She shrugged. "Those who are able to save themselves generally do."
"Well, you're wrong. All my family are still here in Moscow."
"Perhaps I misjudged you. Would you like a pancake?" She opened her packet to reveal four pale-colored patties wrapped in cabbage leaves.
"Try one."
He accepted and took a bite. It was not very tasty.
"What is it?"
"Potato peelings. You can get a bucketful free at the back door of any party canteen or officer's mess. You mince them small in the kitchen grinder, boil them until they're soft, mix them with a little flour and milk, add salt if you've got any, and fry them in lard."
"I didn't know you were so badly off," he said, feeling embarrassed. "You can always get a meal at our place, you know."
"Thank you. What brings you here?"
"A question. What is isotope separation by gaseous diffusion?"
She stared at him.
"Oh my God, what's happened?"
"Nothing has happened. I'm simply trying to evaluate some dubious information."
"Are we building a fission bomb at last?"
Her reaction told him that the information from Frunze was probably sound. She had immediately understood the significance of what he said.
"Please answer the question," Volodya said sternly. "Even though we're friends, this is official business."
"Okay. Do you know what an isotope is?"
"No."
"Some elements exist in slightly different forms. Carbon atoms, for example, always have 6 protons, but some have 6 neutrons, and others have 7 or 8. The different types are isotopes, called carbon-12, carbon-13, and carbon-14.
"Simple enough, even for a student of languages," Volodya said.
"Why is it important?"
"Uranium has 2 isotopes, U-235 and U-238. In natural uranium, the two are mixed up, but only U-235 is explosive.
So we need to separate them.
Gaseous diffusion would be one way, theoretically. When a gas is diffused through a membrane, the lighter molecules pass through faster, so the emerging gas is richer in the lower isotope. Of course, I've never seen it done."
Frunze's report said that the British were building a gaseous diffusion plant in Wales, in the west of the United Kingdom. The Americans were also building one.
"Would there be any other purpose for such a plant?"
"I know of no other reason for separating isotopes." She shook her head.
"Figure the odds. Anyone who prioritizes this kind of process in wartime is either going crazy or building a weapon."
Volodya saw a car approach the barricade and begin to negotiate the zigzag passage. It was a KIM-10, a small 2-door car designed for affluent families. It had a top speed of 60 miles per hour, but this one was so overloaded it probably would not do 40. A man in his 60s was at the wheel, wearing a hat and a Western-style cloth coat. Beside him was a young woman in a fur hat. The back seat of the car was piled with cardboard boxes. There was a piano strapped precariously to the roof. This was clearly a senior member of the ruling elite trying to get out of town with his wife or mistress, and as many of his valuables as he could take. The kind of person Zoya assumed Volodya to be, which was perhaps why she had declined to go out with him. He wondered if she might be revising her opinion of him. One of the barricade volunteers moved a hedgehog in front of the KIM-10, and Volodya saw that there was going to be trouble. The car inched forward until its bumper touched the hedgehog. Perhaps the driver thought he could nudge it out of the way. Several more women came closer to watch. The device was designed to resist being pushed out of the way. Its legs dug into the ground, jamming, and it stuck fast. There was a sound of bending metal as the car's front bumper deformed. The driver put it in reverse and backed off. He stuck his head out of the window and yelled, "Move that thing right now!" He sounded as if he was used to being obeyed. The volunteer, a chunky middle-aged woman wearing a man's checked cap, folded her arms. She shouted, "Move it yourself, deserter!" The driver got out, red-faced with anger, and Volodya was surprised to recognize Colonel Bobrov, whom he had known in Spain. Bobrov had been famous for shooting his own men in the back of the head if they retreated. "No mercy for cowards," had been his slogan. At Belchite, Volodya had personally seen him kill 3 international brigade troops for retreating when they ran out of ammunition. Now Bobrov was in civilian clothes. Volodya wondered if he would shoot the woman who had blocked his way. Bobrov walked to the front of the car and took hold of the hedgehog. It was heavier than he expected, but with an effort he was able to drag it out of the way. As he was walking back to his car, the woman in the cap replaced the hedgehog in front of the car. The other volunteers were now crowding around, watching the confrontation, grinning and making jokes. Bobrov walked up to the woman, taking from his coat pocket an identification card. "I am General Bobrov," he said. He must have been promoted since returning from Spain. "Let me pass." "You call yourself a soldier?" the woman sneered. "Why aren't you fighting?" Bobrov flushed. He knew her contempt was justified. Volodya wondered if the brutal old soldier had been talked into fleeing by his younger wife. "I call you a traitor," said the volunteer in the cap, "trying to run away with your piano and your young tart." Then she knocked his hat off. Volodya was flabbergasted. He had never seen such defiance of authority in the Soviet Union. Back in Berlin, before the Nazis came to power, he had been surprised by the sight of ordinary Germans fearlessly arguing with police officers, but it did not happen here. The crowd of women cheered. Bobrov still had short, cropped white hair all over his head. He looked at his hat as it rolled across the wet road. He took one step in pursuit, then thought better of it. Volodya was not tempted to intervene. There was nothing he could do against the mob, and anyway he had no sympathy for Bobrov. It seemed just that Bobrov should be treated with the brutality he had always shown to others. Another volunteer, an older woman, wrapped in a filthy blanket, opened the car's trunk.
"Look at all this," she said.
The trunk was full of leather luggage. She pulled out a suitcase and thumbed its catches. The lid came open, and the contents fell out. Lacy underwear, linen petticoats and night dresses, silk stockings and camisoles, all obviously made in the West, finer than anything ordinary Russian women ever saw, let alone bought. The filmy garments dropped into the filthy slush of the street and stuck there like petals on a dunghill. Some of the women started to pick them up. Others seized more suitcases. Bobrov ran to the back of his car and started to shove the women away. This was turning very nasty, Volodya thought. Bobrov probably carried a gun, and he would draw it any second now. But then the woman in the blanket lifted a spade and hit Bobrov hard over the head. A woman who could dig a trench with a spade was no weakling, and the blow made a sickeningly loud thud as it connected. The general fell to the ground, and the woman kicked him. The young mistress got out of the car. The woman in the cap shouted, "Coming to help us dig?" And the others laughed. The general's girlfriend, who looked about 30, put her head down and walked back along the road the way the car had come. The volunteer in the checked cap shoved her, but she dodged between the hedgehogs and started to run. The volunteer ran after her. The mistress was wearing tan suede shoes with a high heel, and she slipped in the wet and fell down. Her fur hat came off. She struggled to her feet and started to run again. The volunteer went after the hat, letting the mistress go. All the suitcases now lay open around the abandoned car. The workers pulled the boxes from the back seat and turned them upside down, emptying the contents onto the road. Cutlery spilled out, china broke, and glassware smashed. Embroidered bedsheets and white towels were dragged through the slush. A dozen pretty pairs of shoes were scattered across the tarmac. Bobrov got to his knees and tried to stand. The woman in the blanket hit him with the spade again. Bobrov collapsed on the ground. She unbuttoned Bobrov's fine wool coat and tried to pull it off him. Bobrov struggled, resisting. The woman became furious and hit Bobrov again and again until he lay still, his cropped white head covered with blood. Then she discarded her old blanket and put Bobrov's coat on. Volodya walked across to Bobrov's unmoving body. The eyes stared lifelessly. Volodya knelt down and checked for breathing, a heartbeat or a pulse. There was none. The man was dead. "No mercy for cowards," Volodya said, but he closed Bobrov's eyes. Some of the women unstrapped the piano. The instrument slid off the car roof and hit the ground with a discordant clang. They began gleefully to smash it up with picks and shovels. Others were quarreling over the scattered valuables, snatching up the cutlery, bundling the bedsheets, tearing the fine underwear as they struggled for possession. Fights broke out. A china teapot came flying through the air and just missed Zoya's head. Volodya hurried back to her. "This is developing into a full-scale riot," he said. "I've got an army car and a driver. I'll get you out of here." She hesitated only for a second. "Thanks," she said, and they ran to the car, jumped in, and drove away. 2. Erich von Ulrich's faith in the Führer was vindicated by the invasion of the Soviet Union. As the German armies raced across the vastness of Russia, sweeping the Red Army aside like chaff, Erich rejoiced in the strategic brilliance of the leader to whom he had given his allegiance. Not that it was easy. During rainy October, the countryside had been a mudbath. They called it the Rasputitsa, the time of no roads. Erich's ambulance had plowed through a quagmire. A wave of mud built up in front of the vehicle, gradually slowing it, until he and Hermann had to get out and clear it away with shovels before they could drive any farther. It was the same for the entire German army, and the dash for Moscow had slowed to a crawl. Furthermore, the swamped roads meant that supply trucks never caught up. The army was low on ammunition, fuel, and food, and Erich's unit was dangerously short of drugs and other medical necessities. So Erich had at first rejoiced when the frost had set in at the beginning of November. The freeze seemed a blessing, making the roads hard again and allowing the ambulance to move at normal speed. But Erich shivered in his summer coat and cotton underwear. Winter uniforms had not yet arrived from Germany, nor had the low-temperature lubricants needed to keep the engine of his ambulance operating, and the engines of all the army's trucks, tanks, and artillery. While on the road, Erich got up every 2 hours in the night to start his engine and run it for 5 minutes, the only way to keep the oil from congealing and the coolant from freezing solid. Even then, he cautiously lit a fire under the vehicle every morning an hour before moving off. Hundreds of vehicles broke down and were abandoned. The planes of the Luftwaffe, left outside all night on makeshift airfields, froze solid and refused to start, and air cover for the troops simply disappeared. Despite all that, the Russians were retreating. They fought hard, but they were always pushed back. Erich's unit stopped continually to clear away Russian bodies, and the frozen dead stacked by the roadside made a grisly embankment. Relentlessly, remorselessly, the German army was closing in on Moscow. Soon, Erich felt sure, he would see panzers majestically rolling across Red Square, while swastika banners fluttered jubilantly from the towers of the Kremlin. Meanwhile, the temperature was -10°C and falling. Erich's field hospital unit was in a small town beside a frozen canal, surrounded by spruce forest. Erich did not know the name of the place. The Russians often destroyed everything as they retreated, but this town had survived more or less intact. It had a modern hospital, which the Germans had taken over. Dr. Weiss had briskly instructed the local doctors to send their patients home, regardless of condition. Now Erich studied a frostbite patient, a boy of about 18. The skin of his face was a waxy yellow, and frozen hard to the touch. When Eric and Hermann cut away the flimsy summer uniform, they saw that the arms and legs were covered with purple blisters. The torn and broken boots had been stuffed with newspaper in a pathetic attempt to keep out the cold. When Eric took them off, he smelled the characteristic rotting stink of gangrene. Nevertheless, he thought they might yet save the boy from amputation. They knew what to do. They were treating more men for frostbite than for combat wounds. He filled a bathtub, then he and Hermann Braun lowered the patient into the warm water. Eric studied the body as it thawed. He saw the black color of gangrene on one foot and the toes of the other. When the water began to cool, they took him out, patted him dry, put him in a bed, and covered him with blankets. Then they surrounded him with hot stones wrapped in towels. The patient was conscious and alert. He said, "Am I going to lose my foot?" "That's up to the doctor," Eric said automatically. "We're just orderlies."
"But you see a lot of patients," he persisted. "What's your best guess?"
"I think you might be all right," Eric said. If not, he knew what would happen. On the foot less badly affected, Weiss would amputate the toes, cutting them off with a big pair of clippers like bolt cutters. The other leg would be amputated below the knee. Weiss came a few minutes later and examined the boy's feet. "Prepare the patient for amputation," he said brusquely. Eric was desolate. Another strong young man was going to spend the rest of his life a cripple. What a shame. But the patient saw it differently.
"Thank God," he said. "I won't have to fight anymore."
As they got the boy ready for surgery, Eric reflected that the patient was one of many who persisted in a defeatist attitude, his own family among them. He thought a lot about his late father, and felt deep rage mingled with his grief and loss. The old man would not have joined in with the majority and celebrated the triumph of the Third Reich, he thought bitterly. He would have complained about something, questioned the Führer's judgment, undermined the morale of the armed forces. Why had he had to be such a rebel? Why had he been so attached to the outdated ideology of democracy? Freedom had done nothing for Germany, whereas fascism had saved the country. He was angry with his father, yet hot tears came to his eyes when he thought about how he had died. Eric had at first denied that the Gestapo had killed him, but he soon realized it was probably true. They were not Sunday school teachers. They beat people who told wicked lies about the government. Father had persisted in asking whether the government was killing handicapped children. He had been foolish to listen to his English wife and his over-emotional daughter. Eric loved them, which made it all the more painful to him that they were so misguided and obstinate. While on leave in Berlin, Eric had gone to see Hermann's father, the man who had first revealed the exciting Nazi philosophy to him when he and Hermann were boys. Herr Braun was in the SS now. Eric said he had met a man in a bar who claimed the government killed disabled people in special hospitals. "It is true that the handicapped are a costly drag on the forward march to the new Germany," Herr Braun had said to Eric. "The race must be purified by repressing Jews and other degenerate types, and preventing mixed marriages that produce mongrel people. But euthanasia has never been Nazi policy. We are determined, tough, even brutal sometimes, but we do not murder people. That is a communist lie." Father's accusations had been wrong. Still, Eric wept sometimes. Fortunately, he was frantically busy. There was always a morning rush of patients, mostly men injured the day before. Then there was a short lull before the first new casualties of the day. When Weiss had operated on the frostbitten boy, he and Eric and Hermann took a mid-morning break in the cramped staff room. Hermann looked up from a newspaper. "In Berlin, they're saying we've already won," he exclaimed. "They ought to come here and see for themselves." Dr. Weiss spoke with his usual cynicism. "The Führer made the most interesting speech at the Sportpalast," he said. "He spoke of the bestial inferiority of the Russians. I find that reassuring. I had the impression that the Russians were the toughest fighters we have yet come across.
They have fought longer and harder than the Poles, the Belgians, the Dutch, the French, or the British. They may be under-equipped and badly led and half-starved, but they come running at our machine guns, waving their obsolete rifles as if they don't care whether they live or die. I'm glad to hear that this is no more than a sign of their bestiality. I was beginning to fear that they might be courageous and patriotic. As always, Weiss pretended to agree with the Führer, while meaning the opposite. Hermann just looked confused, but Erich understood and was infuriated. "Whatever the Russians may be, they're losing," he said. "We're 40 miles from Moscow. The Führer has been proved right."
"And he is much smarter than Napoleon," said Dr. Weiss.
"In Napoleon's time, nothing could move faster than a horse," said Erich. "Today we have motor vehicles and wireless telegraphy. Modern communications have enabled us to succeed when Napoleon failed."
"Or they will have, when we take Moscow."
"Which we will do in a few days, if not hours. You can hardly doubt that." "Can I not? I believe some of our own generals have suggested we halt where we are and build a defense line. We could secure our positions, resupply over the winter, and go back on the offensive when the spring comes."
"That sounds to me like treacherous cowardice," Erich said hotly.
"You are right. You must be, because that is exactly what Berlin told the generals, I understand. Headquarters people obviously have a better perspective than the men on the front line."
"We have almost wiped out the Red Army."
"But Stalin seems to produce more armies from nowhere, like a magician. At the beginning of this campaign we thought he had 200 divisions. Now we think he has more than 300. Where did he find another 100 divisions?
The Führer's judgment will be proved right again.
"Of course it will, Erich.
He has never yet been wrong.
A man thought he could fly, so he jumped off the top of a 10-story building, and as he fell past the 5th floor, flapping his arms uselessly in the air, he was heard to say, 'So far, so good.'" A soldier rushed into the staff room.
"There's been an accident," he said, "at the quarry north of the town. A collision, 3 vehicles. Some SS officers are injured."
The SS, or Schutzstaffel, had originally been Hitler's personal guard, and now formed a powerful elite. Erich admired their superb discipline, their ultra-smart uniforms, and their specially close relationship with Hitler.
"We'll send an ambulance," said Weiss.
The soldier said, "It's the Einsatzgruppe, the special group."
Erich had heard of the special groups, vaguely. They followed the army into conquered territory and rounded up troublemakers and potential saboteurs, such as communists. They were probably setting up a prison camp outside the town.
"How many hurt?" asked Weiss.
6 or 7. They're still getting people out of the cars."
"Okay. Braun and von Ulrich, you go."
Erich was pleased. He would be glad to rub shoulders with the Führer's most fervent supporters, even happier if he could be of service to them. The soldier handed him a message slip with directions. Erich and Hermann gulped their tea, stubbed their cigarettes, and left the room. Erich put on a fur coat he had taken from a dead Russian officer, but left it open to show his uniform. They hurried down to the garage, and Hermann drove the ambulance out into the street. Erich read out the directions, peering through a light snowfall. The road led out of town and snaked through the forest. They passed several buses and trucks coming the other way. The snow on the road was packed hard, and Hermann could not go fast on the glossy surface. Erich could easily imagine how there had been a collision. It was the afternoon of the short day. At this time of year, daylight began at 10 and ended at 5. A gray light came through the snow clouds. The tall pine trees, crowding in on either side, darkened the road further. Erich felt as if he were in one of the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm, following the path into the deep wood where evil lurked. They looked out for a turning to the left, and found it guarded by a soldier who pointed the way. They bumped along a treacherous path between the trees, until they were waved down by a 2nd guard, who said, "Don't go faster than walking pace. That's how the crash happened." A minute later, they came upon the accident.
Three damaged vehicles stood as if welded together, a bus, a jeep, and a Mercedes limousine, with snow chains on the tires. Eric and Hermann jumped out of their ambulance. The bus was empty. There were three men on the ground, perhaps the occupants of the jeep. Several soldiers gathered around the car, sandwiched between the other two vehicles, apparently trying to get the people out of it. Eric heard a volley of rifle fire, and wondered for a moment who was shooting. But he put the thought aside and concentrated on the job. He and Hermann went from one man to the next, assessing the gravity of the injuries. Of the three people on the ground, one was dead, another had a broken arm, and the third appeared to be no worse than bruised. In the car, one man had bled to death, another was unconscious, and a third was screaming. Eric gave the screamer a shot of morphine. When the drug took effect, he and Hermann were able to get the patient out of the car and into the ambulance. With him out of the way, the soldiers could begin to free the unconscious man, who was trapped by the deformed bodywork of the Mercedes. The man had a head injury that was going to kill him anyway, Eric thought, but he did not tell them that. He turned his attention to the men from the jeep. Hermann put a splint on the broken arm, and Eric walked the bruised man to the ambulance and sat him inside. He returned to the Mercedes. "We'll have him out in 5 to 10 minutes, said a captain. Just hold on.
Okay, said Eric.
He heard shooting again, and walked a little farther into the forest, curious about what the special group might be doing here. The snow on the ground between the trees was heavily trodden and littered with cigarette ends, apple cores, discarded newspapers, and other litter, as if a factory outing had passed this way. He entered a clearing where lorries and buses were parked. A lot of people had been brought here. Some buses were leaving, skirting the accident. Another arrived as Eric passed through. Beyond the parking lot, he came upon 100 or so Russians of all ages, apparently prisoners, though many had suitcases, boxes, and sacks that they clutched as if guarding precious possessions. One man held a violin. A little girl with a doll caught Eric's eye, and he felt in his guts a sensation of sick foreboding. The prisoners were being guarded by local policemen, armed with truncheons. Clearly the special group had collaborators for whatever they were doing. The policemen looked at him, noted the German army uniform visible beneath the unbuttoned coat, and said nothing. As he walked by, a well-dressed Russian prisoner spoke to him in German.
"Sir, I am the director of the tire factory in this town. I have never believed in communism, but only paid lip service, as all managers had to. I can help you. I know where everything is. Please take me away from here."
Eric ignored him and walked in the direction of the shooting. He came upon the quarry. It was a large, irregular hole in the ground, its edge fringed by tall spruce trees, like guardsmen in dark green uniforms laden with snow. At one end, a long slope led into the pit. As he watched, a dozen prisoners began to walk down, two by two, marshaled by soldiers, into the shadowed valley. Eric noticed three women and a boy of about 11 among them. Was their prison camp somewhere in that quarry? But they were no longer carrying luggage. Snow fell on their bare heads like a benison. Eric spoke to an SS sergeant standing nearby.
"Who are these prisoners, Sarge?"
"Communists," said the man, "from the town, political commissars and so on."
"What, even that little boy?"
"Jews, too," said the sergeant.
"Well, what are they, communists or Jews?"
"What's the difference?"
"It's not the same thing."
"Balls. Most communists are Jews. Most Jews are communists. Don't you know anything?"
The tire factory director who had spoken to Eric seemed to be neither, he thought. The prisoners reached the rocky floor of the quarry. Until this moment they had shuffled along like sheep in a herd, not speaking or looking around, but now they became animated, pointing at something on the ground. Peering through the snowflakes, Eric saw what looked like bodies scattered among the rocks, snow dusting their garments. For the first time Eric noticed 12 riflemen standing on the lip of the ravine, among the trees. 12 prisoners, 12 riflemen. He realized what was happening here, and incredulity mixed with horror rose like bile inside him. They raised their guns and aimed at the prisoners.
No,
Eric said.
No, you can't.
Nobody heard him. A woman prisoner screamed. Eric saw her grab the 11-year-old boy and clasp him to herself, as if her arms around him could stop bullets. She seemed to be his mother. An officer said, "Fire!" The rifles cracked. The prisoners staggered and fell. The noise dislodged a little snow from the pines, and it fell on the riflemen, a sprinkling of pure white. Eric saw the boy and his mother drop, still locked together in an embrace.
No,
he said.
Oh, no.
The sergeant looked at him.
What's the matter with you?
He said irritably.
Who are you, anyway?
Medical orderly,
said Eric, without taking his eyes off the dread scene in the pit.
What are you doing here?
I brought an ambulance for the officers hurt in the collision. Eric saw that another 12 prisoners were already being marched down the slope into the quarry.
Oh, God, my father was right, he moaned. We're murdering people.
Stop whining and fuck off back to your ambulance.
Yes, Sergeant, said Eric.
3. At the end of November, Volodya asked for a transfer to a fighting unit. His intelligence work no longer seemed important. The Red Army did not need spies in Berlin to discover the intentions of a German army that was already on the outskirts of Moscow, and he wanted to fight for his city. His misgivings about the government came to seem trivial. Stalin's stupidity, the brutishness of the secret police, the way nothing in the Soviet Union worked the way it was supposed to work, all that faded away. He felt nothing but a blazing need to repel the invader who threatened to bring violence, rape, starvation, and death to his mother, his sister, the twins Dimka and Tanya, and Zoya. He was sharply aware that if everyone thought that way, he would have no spies. His German informants were people who had decided that patriotism and loyalty were outweighed by the terrible wickedness of the Nazis. He was grateful to them for their courage and the stern morality that drove them. But he felt differently. So did many of the younger men in Red Army intelligence, and a small company of them joined a rifle battalion at the beginning of December. Volodya kissed his parents, wrote a note to Zoya saying he hoped to survive to see her again, and moved into barracks. At long last, Stalin brought reinforcements from the east to Moscow. 13 Siberian divisions were deployed against the ever-nearer Germans. On their way to the front line, some of them stopped briefly in Moscow, and Muscovites on the streets stared at them in their white padded coats and warm sheepskin boots, with their skis and goggles and hardy steppe ponies. They arrived in time for the Russian counterattack. This was the Red Army's last chance. Time and time again, in the last 5 months, the Soviet Union had hurled hundreds of thousands of men at the invaders. Each time the Germans had paused, dealt with the attack, and continued their relentless advance. But if this attempt failed, there would be no more. The Germans would have Moscow, and when they had Moscow, they would have the USSR. And then his mother would be trading vodka for black market milk for Dimka and Tanya. On the 4th day of December, the Soviet forces moved out of the city to the north, west, and south, and took up their positions for the last effort. They went without lights, to avoid alerting the enemy. They were not allowed to have fires or smoke tobacco. That evening the front line was visited by NKVD agents. Volodya did not see his rodent-faced brother-in-law Ilya Dvorkin, who must have been among them. A pair he did not recognize came to the bivouac, where Volodya and a dozen men were cleaning their rifles. "Have you heard anyone criticizing the government?" they asked. "What do the fellows say about Comrade Stalin? Who among your comrades questions the wisdom of the army's strategy and tactics?" Volodya was incredulous. What did it matter at this point? In the next few days, Moscow would be saved or lost. Who cared if soldiers bitched about their officers? He cut the questioning short, saying that he and his men were under a rule of silence, and he had orders to shoot anyone who broke it. But, he added recklessly, he would let the secret policemen off if they left immediately. That worked, But Volodya had no doubt that the NKVD was undermining the morale of the troops all along the line. On Friday, December 5th, in the evening, the Russian artillery thundered into action. Next morning at dawn, Volodya and his battalion moved off in a blizzard. Their orders were to take a small town on the far side of a canal. Volodya ignored orders to attack the German defenses frontally. That was the old-fashioned Russian tactic, and this was no moment to stick obstinately to wrong-headed ideas. With his company of 100 men, he went upstream and crossed the ice to the north of the town, then moved in on the Germans' flank. He could hear the crash and roar of battle off to his left, so he knew he was behind the enemy's front line. Volodya was almost blinded by the blizzard. The occasional blaze of gunfire lit up the clouds for a moment, but at ground level, visibility was only a few yards. However, he thought optimistically, that would help the Russians creep up on the Germans and take them by surprise. It was viciously cold, down to minus 35 degrees centigrade in places, and while this was bad for both sides, it was worse for the Germans, who lacked cold weather supplies. Somewhat to his surprise, Volodya found that the normally efficient Germans had not consolidated their line. There were no trenches, no anti-tank ditches, no dugouts. Their front was no more than a series of strong points. It was easy to slip through the gaps into the town and look for soft targets, barracks and canteens and ammunition dumps. His men shot three sentries to take a soccer field in which were parked 50 tanks. Could it be so easy? Volodya wondered. Was the force that had conquered half Russia now depleted and spent? The corpses of Soviet soldiers, killed in previous skirmishes and left to freeze where they had died, were without their boots and coats, which had presumably been taken by shivering Germans. The streets of the town were littered with abandoned vehicles, empty trucks with open doors, snow-covered tanks with cold engines, and jeeps with their bonnet lids propped up, as if to show that mechanics had tried to fix them but had given up in despair. Crossing a main road, Volodya heard a car engine and made out, through the snowfall, a pair of headlights approaching on his left. At first he assumed it was a Soviet vehicle that had pushed through the German lines. Then he and his group were fired on, and he yelled at them to take cover. The car turned out to be a Kübelwagen, a Volkswagen Jeep with the spare wheel on the hood in front. It had an air-cooled engine, which was why it had not frozen up. It rattled past them at top speed, the Germans firing from their seats. Volodya was so surprised that he forgot to fire back. Why was a vehicle full of armed Germans driving away from the battle? He took his company across the road. He had expected that by now they would be fighting their way from house to house, but they met little opposition. The buildings of the occupied town were locked up, shuttered, dark. Any Russians inside were hiding under their beds, if they had any sense. More cars came along the road, and Volodya decided that officers must be fleeing the battlefield. He detailed a section with a Degtyarov DP-28 light machine gun to take cover in a cafe and fire on them. He did not want them to live to kill Russians tomorrow. Just off the main road, he spotted a low brick building with bright lights behind skimpy curtains. Creeping past a sentry, who could not see far in the snowstorm, he was able to peer in and discern officers inside. He guessed he was looking at a battalion headquarters. He gave whispered instructions to his sergeants. They shot out the windows, then tossed grenades through. A few Germans came out with their hands on their heads. A minute later, Volodya had taken the building. He heard a new noise. He listened, frowning in puzzlement. More than anything else, it sounded like a football crowd. He stepped out of the headquarters building. The sound was coming from the front line, and it was growing louder. There was a rattle of machine gun fire. Then, 100 yards away on the main road, a truck slewed sideways and careered off the road into a brick wall, then burst into flames, hit, presumably, by the DP-28 Volodya had deployed. Two more vehicles followed immediately behind it and escaped. Volodya ran to the cafe. The machine gun stood on its bipod on a dining table. This model was nicknamed Record Player because of the disc-shaped magazine that sat atop the barrel. The men were enjoying themselves. "It's like shooting pigeons in the yard, sir," said a gunner. "Easy, One of the men had raided the kitchen and found a big canister of ice cream, miraculously unspoiled, and they were taking turns to scoff it. Volodya looked out through the smashed window of the cafe. He saw another vehicle coming. A jeep, he thought, and behind it some men running. As they got nearer, he recognized German uniforms. More followed behind, dozens, perhaps hundreds. They were responsible for the football crowd sound. The gunner trained the barrel on the oncoming car, but Volodya put a hand on his shoulder. "Wait," he said. He stared into the blizzard, making his eyes sting. All he could see was more vehicles and more running men, plus a few horses. A soldier raised a rifle.
"Don't shoot," Volodya said.
The crowd came closer.
"We can't stop this lot. We'd be overrun in a minute," he said.
"Let them pass.
Take cover."
The men lay down. The gunner lifted the DP-28 off the table. Volodya sat on the floor and peered over the windowsill. The noise rose to a roar. The leading men drew level with the cafe and passed. They were running, stumbling and limping. Some carried rifles, most seemed to have lost their weapons. Some had coats and hats, others nothing but their uniform tunics. Many were wounded. Volodya saw a man with a bandaged head fall down, crawl a few yards, and collapse. No one took any notice. A cavalryman on horseback trampled an infantryman and galloped on, heedless. Jeeps and staff cars drove dangerously through the crowd, skidding on the ice, honking madly and scattering men to both sides. It was a rout, Volodya realized. They went by in their thousands. It was a stampede. They were on the run. At last, the Germans were in retreat. Chapter 11, 1941, Part 4. Woody Dewar and Joanne Rusrock flew from Oakland, California to Honolulu on a Boeing B-314 flying boat. The Pan Am flight took 14 hours. Just before arriving, they had a massive row. Perhaps it was spending so long in a small space. The flying boat was one of the biggest planes in the world, but passengers sat in one of six small cabins, each of which had two facing rows of four seats. "I prefer the train," said Woody, awkwardly crossing his long legs, and Joanne had the grace not to point out that you could not go to Hawaii by train. The trip was Woody's parents' idea. They had decided to take a vacation in Hawaii so they could see Woody's younger brother Chuck, who was stationed there. Then they invited Woody and Joanne to join them for a second week of the holiday. Woody and Joanne were engaged. Woody had proposed at the end of the summer, after 4 weeks of hot weather and passionate love in Washington. Joanne had said it was too soon, but Woody had pointed out that he had been in love with her for 6 years, and asked how long would be enough. She had given in. They would get married next June, as soon as Woody graduated from Harvard. Meanwhile, their engaged status entitled them to go on family holidays together. She called him Woods, and he called her Joe. The plane began to lose height as they approached Oahu, the main island. They could see forested mountains, a sparse scatter of villages in the lowlands, and a fringe of sand and surf. "I bought a new swimsuit," Joanne said. They were sitting side by side, and the roar of the four Wright twin Cyclone 14-cylinder engines was too loud for her to be overheard. Woody was reading The Grapes of Wrath, but he put it down willingly. "I can't wait to see you in it." He meant it. She was a swimsuit manufacturer's dream, making all their products look sensational. She glanced at him from under half-closed eyelids. "I wonder if your parents booked us adjoining rooms at the hotel." Her dark brown eyes seemed to smolder. Their engaged status did not allow them to sleep together, at least not officially, though Woody's mother did not miss much, and she might have guessed they were lovers. Woody said, "I'll find you, wherever you are." "You'd better." "Don't talk like that. I'm already uncomfortable enough in this seat." She smiled contentedly. The American naval base came into view. A lagoon, shaped like a palm leaf, formed a large natural harbor. Half the Pacific Fleet was here, about 100 ships. The rows of fuel storage tanks looked like checkers on a board. In the middle of the lagoon was an island with an airstrip. At the western end of the island, Woody saw a dozen or more seaplanes moored. Right next to the lagoon was Hickam Air Base. Several hundred aircraft were parked with military precision, wingtip to wingtip, on the tarmac. Banking for its approach, the plane flew over a beach with palm trees and gaily striped umbrellas, which Woody guessed must be Waikiki, then a small town that had to be Honolulu, the capital. Joanne was owed some leave by the State Department, but Woody had had to skip a week of classes in order to take this vacation.
"I'm kind of surprised at your father," Joanne said.
"He's usually against anything that interrupts your education."
"I know," said Woody. "But you know the real reason for this trip, Joe?
He thinks it could be the last time we see Chuck alive."
"Oh my God, really?"
"He thinks there's going to be a war, and Chuck is in the Navy."
"I think he's right. There will be a war."
"What makes you so sure?" "The whole world is hostile to freedom." She pointed to the book in her lap, a bestseller called Berlin Diary, by the radio broadcaster William Shirer.
"The Nazis have Europe," she said. "The Bolsheviks have Russia, and now the Japanese are taking control of the Far East. I don't see how America can survive in such a world. We have to trade with somebody."
"That's pretty much what my father thinks. He believes we'll go to war against Japan next year." Woody frowned thoughtfully. "What's happening in Russia?"
"The Germans don't seem quite able to take Moscow. Just before I left, there was a rumor of a massive Russian counterattack."
"Good news." Woody looked out. He could see Honolulu Airport. The plane would splash down in a sheltered inlet alongside the runway, he presumed. Joanne said,
"I hope nothing major happens while I'm away."
"Why?"
"I want a promotion, Woods, so I don't want someone bright and promising to shine in my absence."
"Promotion? You didn't say."
"I don't have it yet, but I'm aiming for research officer."
He smiled. "How high do you want to go?"
"I'd like to be ambassador to someplace fascinating and complex, Nanking or Addis Ababa."
"Really?
Don't look skeptical. Frances Perkins is the first woman Secretary of Labor, and a damn good one."
Woody nodded. Perkins had been Labor Secretary from the start of Roosevelt's presidency 8 years ago, and had won union support for the New Deal. An exceptional woman could aspire to almost anything nowadays, and Joanne was truly exceptional. But somehow it came as a shock to him that she was so ambitious.
"But an ambassador has to live overseas," he said. "Wouldn't it be great? Foreign culture, weird weather, exotic customs."
"But how does that fit in with marriage?"
"Excuse me?" she said with asperity.
He shrugged. "It's a natural question, don't you think?" Her expression did not change, except that her nostrils flared, a sign he knew that she was getting angry.
"Have I asked you that question?" she said.
"No, but..."
"Well?"
"I'm just wondering, Joe, do you expect me to live wherever your career takes you?"
"I'll try to fit in with your needs, and I think you should try to fit in with mine."
"But it's not the same."
"Isn't it?"
She was openly annoyed now.
"This is news to me."
He wondered how the conversation had become so acrimonious so quickly. With an effort at making his tone of voice reasonable and amiable, he said,
"We've talked about having children, haven't we?"
"You'll have them as well as me." "Not in exactly the same way. If children are going to make me a second-class citizen in this marriage, then we're not having any." "That's not what I mean."
"What the heck do you mean?"
"If you're appointed ambassador somewhere, do you expect me to drop everything and go with you?"
"I expect you to say, 'My darling, this is a wonderful opportunity for you, and I'm certainly not going to stand in your way.'
Is that unreasonable?"
"Yes."
Woody was baffled and angry. "What's the point of being married if we're not together?"
"If war breaks out, will you volunteer?"
"I guess I might."
"And the army would send you wherever they need you? Europe? The Far East?"
"Well, yes."
"So you'll go wherever your duty takes you, and leave me at home?"
"If I have to."
"But I can't do that."
"It's not the same. Why are you pretending it is?" Strangely enough, my career and my service to my country seem important to me, just as important as yours to you.
You're just being perverse.
Well, Woods, I'm really sorry you think that, because I've been talking very seriously about our future together. Now I have to ask myself whether we even have one.
Of course we do.
Woody could have screamed with frustration.
How did this happen? How did we get to this?
There was a bump, and the plane splashed down in Hawaii. 2. Chuck Duer was terrified that his parents would learn his secret. Back home in Buffalo, he had never had a real love affair. Just a few hasty fumbles in dark alleys with boys he hardly knew. Half the reason he had joined the Navy was to go places where he could be himself without his parents finding out. Since he got to Hawaii, it had been different. Here he was part of an underground community of similar people. He went to bars and restaurants and dance halls where he did not have to pretend to be heterosexual. He had had some affairs, and then he had fallen in love. A lot of people knew his secret, and now his parents were here. His father was invited to visit the Signal Intelligence Unit at the Naval Base, known as Station HYPO. As a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Duer was let into many military secrets, and he had already been shown around Signal Intelligence Headquarters, called Op 20G, in Washington. Chuck picked him up at his hotel in Honolulu in a Navy car, a Packard LeBaron limousine. Papa was wearing a white straw hat. As they drove around the rim of the harbor, he whistled.
"The Pacific Fleet," he said. "A beautiful sight."
Chuck agreed.
"Quite something, isn't it?" he said.
Ships were beautiful, especially in the U.S. Navy, where they were painted and scrubbed and shined. Chuck thought the Navy was great.
"All those battleships in a perfect straight line," Gus marveled.
"We call it Battleship Rome, moored off the island or Maryland, Tennessee, Arizona, Nevada, Oklahoma, and West Virginia. Battleships were named after states. We also have California and Pennsylvania in harbor, but you can't see them from here." At the main gate to the Navy Yard, the Marine on sentry duty recognized the official car and waved them in. They drove to the submarine base and stopped in the parking lot behind headquarters, the old administration building. Chuck took his father into the recently opened new wing. Captain Vandermeer was waiting for them. Vandermeer was Chuck's greatest fear. He had taken a dislike to Chuck, and he had guessed the secret. He was always calling Chuck a powder puff or a panty waist. If he could, he would spill the beans. Vandermeer was a short, stocky man with a gravelly voice and bad breath. He saluted Gus and shook hands.
"Welcome, Senator. It'll be my privilege to show you the Communications Intelligence Unit of the 14th Naval District."
This was the deliberately vague title for the group monitoring the radio signals of the Imperial Japanese Navy.
"Thank you, Captain," said Gus.
"A word of warning first, sir. It's an informal group. This kind of work is often done by eccentric people, and correct naval uniform is not always worn. The officer in charge, Commander Rochefort, wears a red velvet jacket."
Vandermeer gave a man-to-man grin.
"You may think he looks like a goddamn homo."
Chuck tried not to wince. Vandermeer said,
"I won't say any more until we're in the secure zone."
"Very good," said Gus. They went down the stairs and into the basement, passing through two locked doors on the way. Station HYPO was a windowless, neon-lit cellar housing 30 men. As well as the usual desks and chairs, it had oversized chart desks, racks of exotic IBM machine printers, sorters, and collators, and two cots where the cryptanalysts took naps during their marathon code-breaking sessions. Some of the men wore neat uniforms, but others, as Vandermeer had warned, were in scruffy civilian clothing, unshaven and, to judge by the smell, unwashed.
"Like all navies, the Japanese have many different codes, using the simplest for less secret signals, such as weather reports, and saving the complex ones for the most highly sensitive messages," Vandermeer said. "For example, Call signs identifying the sender of a message and its destination are in a primitive cipher, even when the text itself is in a high-grade cipher. They recently changed the code for call signs, but we cracked the new one in a few days.
Very impressive, said Gus.
We can also figure out where the signal originated, by triangulation. Given locations and the call signs, we can build up a pretty good picture of where most of the ships of the Japanese Navy are, even if we can't read the messages.
So we know where they are, and what direction they're taking, but not what their orders are, said Gus.
Frequently, yes.
But if they wanted to hide from us, all they would have to do is impose radio silence.
True, said Vandermeer. If they go quiet, this whole operation becomes useless, and we are well and truly fucked up the ears.
A man in a smoking jacket and carpet slippers approached, and Vandermeer introduced the head of the unit.
Commander Rochefort is fluent in Japanese as well as being a master cryptanalyst, Vandermeer said.
We were making good progress decrypting the main Japanese cipher until a few days ago, Rochefort said. Then the bastards changed it and undid all our work. Gus said, Captain Vandermeer was telling me you can learn a lot without actually reading the messages.
Yes, Rochefort pointed to a wall chart. Right now, most of the Japanese fleet has left home waters and is heading south.
Ominous.
It sure is. But tell me, Senator, what's your reading of Japanese intentions?
I believe they will declare war on the United States. Our oil embargo is really hurting them. The British and the Dutch are refusing to supply them, and right now they're trying to ship it from South America. They can't survive like this indefinitely.
Vandermeer said, but what would they achieve by attacking us?
A little country such as Japan can't invade the USA.
Gus said, Great Britain is a little country, but they achieved world domination just by ruling the seas. The Japanese don't have to conquer America, they just need to defeat us in a naval war, so that they can control the Pacific, and no one can stop them trading.
So, in your opinion, what might they be doing heading south?
Their likeliest target has to be the Philippines. Rochefort nodded agreement. We've already reinforced our base there, but one thing bothers me. The commander of the Japanese aircraft carrier fleet hasn't received any signals for several days. Gus frowned. Radio silence. Has that ever happened before?
Yes. Aircraft carriers go quiet when they return to home waters. So we assume that's the explanation this time.
Gus nodded. It sounds reasonable.
Yes, said Rochefort. I just wish I could be sure.
3. The Christmas lights were ablaze on Fort Street in Honolulu. It was Saturday night, December 6th, and the street was thronged with sailors in white tropical uniform, each with a round white cap and a crossed black scarf, all out for a good time. The Doerr family strolled along enjoying the atmosphere, Rosa on Chuck's arm, and Gus and Woody on either side of Joanne. Woody had patched up his quarrel with his fiancée. He apologized for making wrong assumptions about what Joanne expected in their marriage. Joanne admitted she had flown off the handle. Nothing was truly resolved, but it was enough of a rapprochement for them to tear off their clothes and jump into bed. Afterward, the quarrel seemed less important, and nothing really mattered except how much they loved each other. Then they vowed that in the future they would discuss such agreements in a loving and tolerant way. As they got dressed, Woody felt they had passed a milestone. They had had an acrimonious quarrel about a serious difference of view, but they had survived it. It could even be a good sign. Now they were heading out for dinner, Woody carrying his camera, snapping photos of the scene as they walked along. Before they had gone far, Chuck stopped and introduced another sailor.
This is my pal, Eddie Perry. Eddie, meet Senator Doerr. Mrs. Doerr, my brother Woody, and Woody's fiancée, Miss Joanne Ruzrock.
Rosa said, I'm pleased to meet you, Eddie. Chuck has mentioned you several times in his letters home. Won't you join us for dinner?
We're only going to eat Chinese.
Woody was surprised.
It was not like his mother to invite a stranger to a family meal. Eddie said, "Thank you, ma'am. I'd be honored." He had a southern accent. They went into the Heavenly Delight restaurant and sat down at a table for six. Eddie had formal manners, calling Gus sir and the women ma'am, but he seemed relaxed. After they had ordered, he said, "I've heard so much about this family, I feel as if I know y'all." He had a freckled face and a big smile, and Woody could tell that everyone liked him. Eddie asked Rosa how she liked Hawaii. "To tell you the truth, I'm a little disappointed," she said. "Honolulu is just like any small American town. I expected it to be more Asian." "I agree," said Eddie. "It's all diners and motor courts and jazz bands." He asked Gus if there was going to be a war. Everyone asked Gus that question. "We've tried our darndest to reach a modus vivendi with Japan," Gus said. Woody wondered if Eddie knew what a modus vivendi was. Secretary of State Hall had a whole series of talks with Ambassador Nomura that lasted all summer long, but we can't seem to agree. "What's the problem?" said Eddie. "American business needs a free trade zone in the Far East. Japan says, okay, fine, we love free trade, let's have it, not just in our backyard, but all over the world. The United States can't deliver that, even if we wanted it. So Japan says that as long as other countries have their own economic zone, they need one too. I still don't see why they had to invade China." Rosa, who always tried to see the other side, said, "The Japanese want troops in China and Indochina and the Dutch East Indies to protect their interests, just as we Americans have troops in the Philippines, and the British have theirs in India, and the French in Algiers, and so on." "When you put it that way, the Japs don't seem so unreasonable." Joanne said firmly, "They're not unreasonable, but they're wrong. Conquering an empire is the 19th century solution. The world is changing. We're moving away from empires and closed economic zones. To give them what they want would be a backward step." Their food arrived. "Before I forget," Gus said, "we're having breakfast tomorrow morning aboard the Arizona, 8 o'clock sharp." Chuck said, "I'm not invited, but I've been detailed to get you there. I'll pick you up at 7:30 and drive you to the Navy Yard, then take you across the harbor in a launch." "Fine." Woody tucked into fried rice. "This is great," he said. "We should have Chinese food at our wedding." Gus laughed. "I don't think so." "Why not? It's cheap and it tastes good." "A wedding is more than a meal, it's an occasion. Speaking of which, Joanne, I must call your mother." Joanne frowned. "About the wedding?" "About the guest list." Joanne put down her chopsticks. "Is there a problem?" Woody saw her nostrils flare, and knew there was going to be trouble. "Not really a problem," said Gus. "I have a rather large number of friends and allies in Washington who would be offended if they were not invited to the wedding of my son. I'm going to suggest that your mother and I share the cost." Papa was being thoughtful, Woody guessed. Because Dave had sold his business for a bargain price before he died, Joanne's mother might not have a lot of money to spare for a swanky wedding. But Joanne disliked the idea of the two parents making wedding arrangements over her head. "Who are the friends and allies you're thinking about?" Joanne said coolly. "Senators and congressmen, mostly. We must invite the president, but he won't come." "Which senators and congressmen?" Joanne said. Woody saw his mother hide a grin. She was amused at Joanne's insistence. Not many people had the nerve to push Gus up against the wall like this. Gus began a list of names. Joanne interrupted him. "Did you say Congressman Cobb?"
"Yes."
"He voted against the anti-lynching law."
"Peter Cobb is a good man, but he's a Mississippi politician. We live in a democracy, Joanne. We have to represent our voters. Southerners won't support an anti-lynching law."
He looked at Chuck's friend. "I hope I'm not treading on any toes here, Eddie."
"Don't mince your words on my account, sir," Eddie said. "I'm from Texas, but I feel ashamed when I think of Southern politics. I hate prejudice.
A man's a man, whatever his color.
Woody glanced at Chuck. He looked so proud of Eddie he might have burst. At that moment, Woody realized Eddie was more than just Chuck's pal. That was weird. There were three loving couples around the table. Papa and Mama, Woody and Joanne, and Chuck and Eddie. He stared at Eddie. Chuck's lover, he thought. Damn weird. Eddie caught him staring and smiled amiably. Woody tore his gaze away. Thank God Papa and Mama haven't figured it out, he thought. Unless that was why Mama had invited Eddie to join in a family dinner. Did she know? Did she even approve? No, that was beyond the bounds of possibility. Anyway, Cobb has no choice, Papa was saying, and in everything else he's a liberal. There's nothing democratic about it, Joanne said hotly. Cobb doesn't represent the people of the South. Only white people are allowed to vote there. Gus said, nothing is perfect in this life. Cobb supported Roosevelt's New Deal. That doesn't mean I have to invite him to my wedding. Woody put in, Papa, I don't want him either. He has blood on his hands. That's unfair. It's how we feel. Well, the decision is not entirely up to you. Joanne's mother will be throwing the party, and if she'll let me, I'll share the cost. I guess that gives us at least a say in the guest list. Woody sat back. Heck, it's our wedding. Joanne looked at Woody. Maybe we should have a quiet town hall wedding with just a few friends. Woody shrugged. Suits me. Gus said severely, that would upset a lot of people. But not us, said Woody. The most important person of the day is the bride. I just want her to have what she wants. Rosa spoke up. Listen to me, everyone, she said. Don't let's go overboard. Gus, my darling, you may have to take Peter Cobb aside and explain to him gently that you are lucky enough to have an idealistic son who is marrying a wonderful and equally idealistic girl, and they have stubbornly refused your impassioned request to invite Congressman Cobb to the wedding. You're sorry, but you cannot follow your own inclinations in this any more than Peter can follow his when voting on anti-lynching bills. He will smile and say he understands, and he has always liked you because you're as straight as a die. Gus hesitated for a long moment, then decided to give in graciously. I guess you're right, my dear, he said. He smiled at Joanne. Anyway, I'd be a fool to quarrel with my delightful daughter-in-law on account of Pete Cobb. Joanne said, thank you. Should I start calling you Papa yet? Woody almost gasped. It was the perfect thing to say. She was so damn smart. Gus said, I would really like that. Woody thought he saw the glint of a tear in his father's eye. Joanne said, then thank you, Papa. How about that? Thought Woody. She stood up to him, and she won. What a girl. 4. On Sunday morning, Eddie wanted to go with Chuck to pick up the family at their hotel. I don't know, baby, said Chuck. You and I are supposed to be friendly, not inseparable. They were in bed in a motel at dawn. They had to sneak back into barracks before sunup. You're ashamed of me, said Eddie. How can you say that? I took you to dinner with my family. That was your mama's idea, not yours. But your papa liked me, didn't he? They all adored you. Who wouldn't? But they don't know you're a filthy homo. I am not a filthy homo. I'm a very clean homo. True. Please take me. I want to know them better. It's really important to me. Chuck sighed. Okay. Thank you. Eddie kissed him. Do we have time? Chuck grinned. If we're quick. 2 hours later, they were outside the hotel in the Navy's Packard. Their four passengers appeared at 7:30. Rosa and Joanna wore hats and gloves. Gus and Woody white linen suits. Woody had his camera. Woody and Joanne were holding hands. Look at my brother, Chuck murmured to Eddie. He's so happy. She's a beautiful girl. They held the doors open and the doers climbed into the back of the limousine. Woody and Joanne folded down the jump seats. Chuck pulled away and headed for the naval base. It was a fine morning. On the car radio, station KGMB was playing hymns. The sun shone over the lagoon and glinted off the glass portholes and polished brass rails of 100 ships. Chuck said, "Isn't that a pretty sight?" They entered the base and drove to the Navy Yard, where a dozen ships were in floating docks and dry docks for repair, maintenance, and refueling. Chuck pulled up at the officer's landing. They all got out and looked across the lagoon at the mighty battleships, standing proud in the morning light. Woody took a photo. It was a few minutes before 8 o'clock. Chuck could hear the tolling of church bells in nearby Pearl City. On the ships, the forenoon watch was being piped to breakfast, and color parties were assembling to hoist ensigns at 8 precisely. A band on the deck of the Nevada was playing the Star-Spangled Banner. They walked to the jetty, where a launch was tied up ready for them. The boat was big enough to take a dozen passengers and had an inboard motor under a hatch in the stern. Eddie started the engine while Chuck handed the guests into the boat. The small motor burbled cheerfully. Chuck stood in the bows while Eddie eased the launch away from the dockside and turned toward the battleships. The prow lifted as the launch picked up speed, throwing off twin curves of foam like a seagull's wings. Chuck heard a plane and looked up. It was coming in from the west, so low it looked as if it might be in danger of crashing. He assumed it was about to land at the naval airstrip on Ford Island. Woody, sitting near Chuck in the bows, frowned and said, "What kind of plane is that?" Chuck knew every aircraft of both the Army and the Navy, but he had trouble identifying this one. "It almost looks like a Type 97, he said. That was the carrier-based torpedo bomber of the Imperial Japanese Navy. Woody pointed his camera. As the plane came nearer, Chuck saw large red suns painted on its wings. "It's a Jap plane," he said. Eddie, steering the boat from the stern, heard him.